Hello and welcome. My name is Blana Tracy and this is my podcast, Untold. Across this 10-part series, I'll be taking a look at different facets of Irish society and speaking to people with unique voices and stories. In this episode, I speak with Mia Parsons, who shares her extraordinary story of having to give her child up for adoption when she was just 17 years old, and then how a song helped her find him 26 years later. And if you stay listening to the very end, you'll get to hear that song too. This is Mia's story. So I guess we'll just sort of get straight into it. So when you were 17.
When I was 17, I got pregnant.
You got pregnant. Okay. And your parents weren't too pleased.
No. Well, I mean, that came towards the very late in the pregnancy. They didn't know. So it had to be a complete cover up.
Okay.
You know?
What year was this, by the way?
This was in 1980. Well, I got pregnant in 1980 and 81. I had my baby in 81, October 81. So when I think it was actually January that I discovered I was pregnant that year. Just before, I was 18 in April.
Were you, or when you realised you were pregnant, were you frightened? Were you scared? Were you happy?
I was completely in shock, scared, because I knew that we were still in that era. Well, I mean, at the time, I didn't think we're in an era, but we were in the era, and there was just no way that this was going to go down well with my particular family anyway. And it was a very scary scenario. Okay. And also, when I look back, I know that really I dealt with it in a very childish, I realise looking back, my childish way of dealing with it, because I really was only a child, you know, when I look back now, 17, back in those innocent days, you know.
How do you mean that you behaved in a childish way? Like,
because I immediately got a job abroad in Germany.
Okay.
And went to work over there with my plan being that I would come back and say that I'd found a baby, or that some friend had died in a car crash and I got the baby.
Wow.
And I actually thought I would get away with that.
Really?
Story. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
So you had this plan.
I did a plan. Yeah. Yeah.
And the plan, obviously it didn't go to plan.
No. It was slightly different.
It went slightly differently. So, okay. How far into the pregnancy were you when you moved to Germany?
Probably late February, early March, that I moved to Germany, found an ad in the paper looking for people to work in a bar on what is now Hahn Airport. Used to be an airbase, an American airbase. Not industrial. It was just farmland for miles and miles around. And then this town plonked in the middle of it, and this airbase. American airbases were all over Germany at the time. Anyway, went to work there and, you know, for the first month or so, had great fun because I tried to put it out of my mind, you know, that I was pregnant. And then started to, you know, it started to emerge.
To
you know?
Show, okay. So people started obviously realising.
The woman I was working for, who was a very, her name actually, I have to tell you, was Frau Fallick. I'm not making that up.
Frau Fallick.
Frau Fallick. And she was a big sort of farmer woman. You know, she was a big, you know, horse of a woman. And she...
Hopefully she's not listening.
I don't think so. And she kind of started to suss it after a while that, you know, there was something up and people were starting to mention it. That was I, you know, was there a little bump there or whatever? So anyway, needless to say, I got the sack. And had to go home with my little bump.
Okay.
Although at this stage, I could still kind of hide it, you know what I mean? So it was about May. So I was a good few months in, but I was still kind of, I was small and young and tiny. So I could kind of get away with it. And we were in a baggy jumper era, you know, that sort of thing. Baggy jumpers and overalls were the.
But did anyone, like, did any of your friends know? Did any of your family know?
Yeah.
Did the father of the baby know?
The father of the baby knew. But we had literally had a sort of a very short fling, and it wasn't something I knew definitely that, you know, he's a nice guy, but it wasn't something that I wanted to pursue.
Yeah.
So I did tell him and he offered that his sister would take the baby, but I knew that I couldn't do that.
Yeah.
You know,
okay.
And at this stage I was still believing that I could hatch this plan and make it work, you know?
Yeah.
So what happened? And my sister Barbara knew, and also friends, you know, my close friends knew.
Okay.
And my sister actually came over to Germany to kind of help me come back.
Okay.
And to bring me home to the
to your parents.
Fold.
Oh dear. All right.
And she actually was the one who said it to my mother. I remember sitting in the kitchen in my mother's house, and Barbara went out the back to tell my mother, and I could see my mother kind of folding up. It was like, God, you know, when I look back, God love her, it was really difficult for her to hear this news and just know that she had to face the consequences of the neighbours and the, you know, my father having a fit and, you know, all of this. It was just a really difficult time. It wasn't easy at the time because it wasn't accepted. I know that there were families who were really supportive and said, you won't be going anywhere. We'll be looking after that child. You know, there was that sort of thing. But this wasn't the case here.
So what did she say to you? Like, when did she come back inside, and what did she say to you?
She came in and she was just, I could see she was really upset, and there was no talking. It was a bit of an aspect of my mother. She wasn't good at expressing. Silence was the way she dealt with things, you know.
Right, okay.
But anyway, she told my father, and of course my father had a fit and said, you know, you won't be keeping that baby. You know, I know you've got all rosy. I think my mother secretly would have allowed me to keep the baby because she sort of said, you need to do what you want to do.
Oh, right. Okay. So she actually was wanted you to.
Probably she wanted to, but she also, you know, daddy at the time was saying, you know, you and your mother have this rosy idea of the two of you walking around with a pram, and, you know, it's not going to be like that, and you need to make up your mind and whatever.
When he said you need to make up your mind, what did you have to make
your
mind about?
You need to give the baby up because this isn't going to happen, really. Because we're not supporting you.
Okay.
So therefore, you know, do you want to go off and live, you know, in a bedsit somewhere with this baby, or do you want to give the baby a chance and have the baby adopted? So anyway, like, all my little plan was now completely
shattered.
Yeah, sorry.
Aww.
So this, it was kind of like the scaffold of my plan sort of collapsed, you know. I can't help crying, you know. But looking back, I just know that it was a child with his plan. I just feel sorry for that child.
Yeah.
Anyway. Okay, so immediately my father, I presume, or mother, I'm not sure, but got in touch with an organization called Ally, which was at the time, that was the place where you'd go if you were pregnant. If you didn't go to a Magdalen Laundry or, you know, one of these places, you would go to stay with a family. There were families all over Ireland who would take in people who were pregnant.
Mm. But your parents wanted you to go and stay with the
Oh yeah, because nobody was to know I was pregnant. Right. I was to have this baby. It was to go, and I was to come back babyless and carry on. As if nothing had happened. So off I went. And I remember the day my father dropped me to the church, actually very close to here in Phibsborough. That big church kind of on the V.
Oh yeah, yeah.
And he parked outside, and he kind of left me with my little suitcase. And I went into the church to the underneath of the church to meet with the priest and a woman who was going to meet me and take me to her home. So it was scary because, well, do you know what's sad? I just always felt, to this day, I still have it, that you'll be able for this. You'll have to be strong. I just always felt I had to be strong, and I had to not cry and not show any emotion, that I wanted to make it easier on my parents. Mm. I wanted to make them okay with it. I didn't want them to feel bad about what was happening, and no, I'll be fine. But inside, I was terrified going in here because I didn't know, God knows, who I was going to get.
Yeah.
And luckily enough, I got lovely, lovely people, and they just took me in as one of their own, which was really lovely. But it was lonely as well at the same time, because you just felt like, you know, you were just cut off from everything you knew. Although they were wonderful, it was like, anyway, and the looming knowledge that you were going to have to give up this baby, you know.
Who organized that part of it? The kind of who's going to adopt the child?
At the time, I was visiting with, once this was this the ball was rolling on this, I went to an organization called, at the time they were called the Catholic Protection and Rescue Society. That's who I was sent to.
Oh my God!
Who are now called Cunniff, and they're on South Ann Street, and it's the same building, it's the same lino and the same holy pictures, so as far as I know, in the place.
It's all, this was all wrapped up within the Catholic Church.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
Because there was no other, nobody thought outside the box then. It was either you go to the Protestant one or the Catholic one. There was no other independent one as far as I know. I don't know if there was, but that everything was done through the church, you know.
Yeah.
Back in the day. You didn't even think, I don't want to go through the church, you know.
Yeah.
Now, maybe some people did, but that didn't occur to anybody.
I actually just wanted to ask you one question. When your dad dropped you off at the church and you went in, like, what did the priest say to you? And what did this lady, like, were they kind to you?
Do you know, I can't remember the priest. I can remember, all I can remember of that is that sort of echoey, narrow, polished corridor, you know, with doors and echoes and, you know, that sort of a thing.
Yeah.
I'm walking down and wondering where I was going and somebody directing me into a little place and sitting and waiting.
Yeah.
And Eileen coming in and taking me. I don't really remember. I just know there was somebody I was to meet, a priest who I was to meet.
Right.
So I just remember she came and took me, and she's American. She was lovely, warm.
Yeah.
Lovely woman, you know. So that was an instant release. But I just remember that walk down the corridor was real echoey and,
yeah,
and you're only, where am I going?
You're only a kid yourself.
Yeah.
And it's, all these adults have organized this for you and you're left on your own to deal with it.
Yeah.
It's a lot to.
Yeah.
No wonder you don't remember. You're obviously in shock at the time.
I suppose there must be. I think actually looking back, there are several things around that time that other people say they remember. And I've no. And it isn't just that I don't remember now because it was a long time ago. But at the time, you know, a year later, I didn't remember. So I realized I'd sort of chopped off little bits that I couldn't cope with or whatever.
You're traumatized.
You know? Yeah, I suppose.
Complete. Like, it makes sense.
Sounds a little bit dramatic. I don't mean to be, you know,
no,
I'm sure
I don't
people
think
have been
dramatic.
Way worse than through way worse things, but I suppose everybody's is their own little, you know, personal.
Yeah, but it is a traumatic experience that you went through. I think that's such an Irish response. Like, oh, mine wasn't as bad as someone else's. I mean, it's still a pretty bad situation to find yourself in and to kind of, you know, to be ushered this way and that way. And we're going to do this now. Mm. All these decisions sort of being made for you.
Yeah.
But luckily, the family that you went to stay with were really nice and they were kind to you. And
they were lovely.
And obviously, time is then ticking along.
Yeah.
The bump is getting bigger.
Yeah. And then, you know, fast forward to actually having the baby.
Mm.
And back in the day, you know, the way nowadays you have the baby and you're gone out to the hospital the next day. But back then you were in for 5 days.
Okay.
Could be more, you know.
Yeah.
But 5 days was that time. So I went in, had my baby, and he was immediately taken away because he was born blue, you know. So, he was lacking oxygen or something, which was, you know, it was great. They were looking after him or whatever. But I started to really get very anxious because I thought they don't want me to see him and I'm not going to see him. And I was really getting panic stricken because I wanted this 5 days was it. It was my precious time. So the next day I kind of had to do a little fight and say, where is my baby? I want my baby. And I remember that awful panic. That was really, really dreadful. My mother visited me and I could see how brokenhearted she was. Like lots of visits from lots of people. Everybody was lovely. But, you know, and I was watching people all around because I was in a ward of about 13 or 14 at the time. It was a huge ward. And everybody keeping their babies and making plans and the husbands coming in and grandmothers. And, oh, and I have the nursery ready and I have this ready and I have that ready. And that feeling of just,
oh my God.
Oh, it was dreadful.
That is so cruel that they had you in the ward with all of these other people.
Yeah.
I feel like, why would they do that to you? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It just seems like they weren't considering you in any of this, your feelings.
No,
you
I
know?
Suppose. I never thought about that. And I remember my social worker from this Catholic protection place was actually a lovely girl called Orla. I don't remember her surname, but she was actually a very sensitive person and she was sort of coming in because I had to sign papers while I was in the hospital and she was very sensitive about it. But it was looming, the days were looming, and I remember just talking to him as if he was an adult. I had tried to, like, here again, the child and the way to cope. I had started to write diaries, which I don't have, but during the pregnancy, while I was living in their house, the Ally house, basically saying, okay, you know, talking to the baby and saying, you know, okay, I've the way we're viewing this is that I'm a taxi and I'm bringing you to your family.
Mm.
And, you know, they're going to be amazing and they're going to be so thrilled. And I feel so honored to be bringing you to them. And this was the only way I could kind of pitch it to myself to be able to cope with it, you know?
Yeah.
So again, in the hospital, I had to kind of keep telling myself that. And I had to do things like, oh my God, I'm going to have my figure back, and I'm going to, and I had to sort of try and bring in all these other things and try to, you know, try to pretend that they mattered, so that, you know, to stop allowing this pain, you know?
Yeah.
And then it came to the day where I had to say goodbye to him, which was just horrific. You know, I had to walk down and put him in a little cradle, and Barbara, my sister, came in, and I was just, you know, it was floodgates opened, and I couldn't cope with it. And I walked out to the car. My father was outside in the car. And as I got into the car, and I'm painting my father as an awful man. He's a wonderful, wonderful, funny man. But this particular thing, I just got into the car and he said, that's enough crying. Don't, you'll upset your mother when you go home. That's it. And I didn't cry for months. I couldn't cry. Couldn't access it. Once I stopped it, it was like, it just, that was it. I couldn't access it. And then the guilt over not crying was another story altogether. You know, that just went on for a long, long time. I'll just finish that little bit. When I got into the car and got home, there was no, never mentioned ever again.
Did you? What did your mum say when you got
nothing?
Nothing.
What'll you have for your dinner? Be in at 7 o'clock. Back to where we were. I'd never been allowed out like at night. How I got pregnant at before 7:30. Shkilila. But I'd never been allowed. There was never any freedom because, you know, my parents were terrified of, you know, having four girls and a boy. It was just like, oh my God. So I was just back to, where are you going? When will you be back? And I was now a completely changed person.
Mm.
I'd been through this huge pivotal change in my life, but nothing had changed at home. So I was like, you'll be home at, who will you be with? What time will you be home? And nothing was ever mentioned, ever, to the moment that my mother died. I mentioned my son later to him, but she would change the subject.
Wow.
Literally change. I'd say something about my son and she'd say, is that rain we're getting out there? Literally. She just changed the subject.
And I wonder,
she couldn't cope with it.
Yeah. I wonder, was it a guilt thing? Because you were saying that, I don't know. I mean, it's hard to know. But I guess also your parents are from a different era as well.
Totally. I'll tell you, the real sting in this whole story is that about 6 months or I don't know how long later, but some cousin or somebody got pregnant. And it was like, did you hear Mary got pregnant? She's going to have a baby. Mm. Not married. But yeah, the stigma had kind of diffused slightly around 1981. It had sort of become, I was like the tail end of this whole history.
Yeah.
You know, having... Now, I'm sure it still happened after that, you know.
Of course.
But the real heavy stigma, at least in my little world, was kind of had dissipated at that point.
So time goes, you're 18. Like, you obviously, did you go on with normal life then? Like, what did you do? What was your next phase in your life?
The next phase was the next baby. So I immediately got pregnant again.
Wow.
With the intentions that there was nobody going to take away this baby.
And did you want to get pregnant?
Yeah. Yeah. And I was now with the guy who I'd been in love with all along, who had, it had been off for a little while.
Okay.
And I'd gone out with this guy who was always asking me out. And now I was back with this, this other guy. And so I purposely got pregnant. This father of my daughter and my son, my next son, had been adopted himself, and he had kind of made it okay that I'd given this baby away. He'd sort of said, you know, you did a good thing, and he'd made me feel okay about it, and you know, sort of said like he was happy with his life, he'd been adopted, and you know, it's sort of,
you had that connection with him then.
Sort of, yeah. Yeah. Sort of. Like, again, it was another, like, I was crazy about this guy. He wasn't really crazy about me. It was another one of those. Anyway, listen. So I got pregnant, but, you know, my daughter suffered the consequences of me getting pregnant that early because I was absent. I was there every single day of her life for her, But I was absent in my emotions because I was still suffering that I, and it had never been dealt with. I'd been shut down.
Yeah.
To be honest with you, looking back, I think I was suffering from postnatal depression, which had never been diagnosed because I didn't go to anybody. I never went to a counsellor. You know, the way nowadays you'd be going to counsellors. And actually, there's a new baby in the family and I'm looking at the parents saying, and they're kind of, everything is so, oh, she didn't sleep and she woke up, like, and everybody's so precious about anything. And I'm just about every single moment of this child's life, and they're together and they're supporting each other. And I'm just looking at, I had no support with this baby, this new baby, now this second baby, no support, living in a little flat. There wasn't a sort of, Alison, will you take the baby tonight? I'm going to go out. So I was, now I sound like I purposely did this, but there was no support. And I was just, I suppose I hadn't bargained for the complete no support and what that meant when you have a baby and when you're 19.
Yeah.
And I just like wasn't able for it. You know, I wasn't able for it emotionally because I was also suffering, and I continued for years to suffer from the guilt which eats away at you, that you're not really a good person because you've given away a baby. What sort of a mother are you anyway?
Yeah.
You know, you're that is constantly eating away at you.
You're, for people listening, obviously, you're an incredibly creative person. You're an amazing singer and you're amazing at your hands. You're an amazing jewellery designer. People check out your stuff. Mia Parsons on Instagram is absolutely beautiful, earrings and jewellery. But you actually, you poured your heart and soul into a song about
right,
your son.
Yeah, yeah.
Because I guess you wanted to try and find him eventually.
Well, the song itself found him. And I knew as I was writing the song that I would find him. The song, you know, at the risk of sounding like a complete loony bin, the song was channeled, totally channeled to me. And I can say that with hand and heart. My dog, Winnie, got pregnant and was having pups. And during the time that she was pregnant, at this stage, my child would have been around 26. And the particular agency that I'd been through didn't allow you to start to inquire and make any inquiries until they're 23.
Okay.
So I had started to make inquiries at 23 and no response and no response and no response and, no, and unbelievably inhumane, no response.
No response.
Not from him, from them, from, you know, okay. no getting back to you. We'll get back to you, not getting back. Not. So you get to the point, and I say I speak for lots of people when I say this, where you just start to think, oh, I don't want them to think I'm a bit of a loony bin. I better not ask again. And I'm sure they will get back to me at some point, and they don't. And you just start to panic because it's a little bit like when they put him in the cot that first day. It's like they don't want me to see him. They don't think I'm, you know, you start to make things up in your head.
Yeah.
So at this stage, he's about 25 and Winnie is now pregnant, which sounds a bit mad, but this is how the story goes. And during her pregnancy, I started to ruminate about me being pregnant and watch and wondered how she would feel when she has to give up the pups. I was kind of, it was like an analogy of my thing.
Yeah.
I knew she was going to have to give them up and how would she feel? And I was kind of living with Winnie through this. So it came to the day where somebody was picking up the first two pups and he came in to pick the two of them up and he, and I didn't really think a huge amount about it, you know, consciously, but subconsciously I was. And as he was leaving the house, he was going through the out the front door and he had the puppies on his shoulder and he just said, say goodbye to your mommy now. That was it.
It just brought you back.
It was like I ended up outside the hospital again with my father. It's like the crying began.
Oh, okay.
And I could not stop it.
Wow.
I cried for the whole day. I cried for the whole evening. I went down to the beach that evening. I live near the beach. And on the beach, these words started coming to me. Now, I wasn't in any state to be writing songs because I was absolutely in bits, but these words started coming to me.
Mm.
And I thought, these words are coming to me. I was very conscious that these words were coming to me in the form of like a poem or something. So I went home that night and my partner was saying, we don't live together, but he was saying, I'll stay with you tonight. And I was saying, no, I can't. And he said, no, I'll support you. I'll just stay. It doesn't matter if you cry all night. It's okay. So I literally sat up and I thought, no, I have to write this down because they weren't going away. And I wrote them down and I realized it was a song. And the next day I was, I rang the guitarist I was working with at the time, this Croatian guy, Dražen Derek, and I contacted him and I said, can I come to you and can you put music to a song?
Mm.
So Tuesday I wrote it. Wednesday I go to Drazhen. Mm-hmm. He puts music to it. Thursday we're at a party in Dalkey. And at the party, Drazhen says, do you want to sing that song you wrote? And I sang it. And I couldn't, when it came to the last line, which is a bit of a fall apart line, I fell apart. And I couldn't finish it. And that was the end of that. And I never thought anything about it. And on Sunday, my sister, my oldest sister, who I hadn't seen for ages, rang me and said, did you write a song about adoption? And I said, yeah, how do you know? And she said, they're just talking about it on the radio. Somebody was at a party and they heard the song and they said it has to be heard.
No way.
Now, when I wrote it, I knew as the words were coming, I knew it was going to do the work. I didn't have to do any work. About 2 weeks later, wow. I got a call from the Irish Times saying we heard about this song on the radio.
No way.
Could we do a little interview? So I think it was Sarah, I can't remember her surname, lovely girl Sarah. She interviewed me for the paper. And about a couple of weeks after that, I was driving. Actually, I got a call from RTE saying, we want to do a programme on your search. Would you believe programme?
Yeah.
And I just knew that it was like the road of least resistance. I wasn't doing anything. It was just happening.
Wow.
And that's how it's not like the song didn't go to him and he heard it or anything
but
like that.
It was the catalyst.
It's totally. So what happened was then a wonderful woman called Geraldine Creed, who was the director of the programme, brought me with her camera on her shoulder into the adoption agency. The camera with nothing, like it was a dead camera, but we stormed the place and said, we need answers.
Yes.
And they were starting to think, oh, no, please, out you go. So off we went out and about, Friday. By the Tuesday, I got a call. I was teaching in Boucherstown National School and I got a call saying, are you sitting down? We have found. Now, they had never lost him and they knew exactly where he was. And he was very contactable all that time. They could have easily contacted him.
So they found him. They contacted him.
They contacted him.
Wow.
And he was delighted to hear. Now, it then took ages to put it together. But now I knew. And I knew that I was going to meet him. And
oh, my
incredible.
God. Yeah. What? I'm actually getting teary-eyed. What a moment.
I know. It was incredible. That was in 2006, I think.
Oh my God. Mm. Isn't that absolutely amazing?
It was just incredible. Incredible. And
the universe just working with you and saying you need to meet your son.
Yeah.
It's time of thing. Oh my God.
Absolutely. And I totally believe that. I know people might say, you just happened to write the song at the time. But it wasn't like that. I knew it. I knew the power of it. And because I've had an experience similar to that before. And that was just... there was no question of it. It was just, it came.
Yeah.
And I knew it would do the work and I didn't have to worry anymore.
How did you feel when you got that phone call?
Oh, I just sat down and they said his name and I was like, because I had called him David. And no, I hadn't. I'd called him so many names. I'd called him Paul, but then I called him David to the children. I used to say David is, your brother. I don't know why I changed it. I knew it wouldn't be his name anyway.
Yeah.
And then... eventually I heard his name and I was just like, oh my God, I can't believe it. Never thought of it like that. Never thought he would be like that. And I was just so excited. It was just like the biggest sigh of relief ever.
Mm.
It's hard to put it into words.
So then you know you're going to meet him. Mm. But so how much time passed then from that phone call to when you actually...
I'd say about 4 or 5 months.
Wow, they must have been a long 4 or 5 months.
It was. Well, there was letters. So they start, the process is that you start to write letters to each other, but they go through the agency and to you. So you still feel like you're being vetted all the time, that you're not quite good enough. Right up to the day I met him, I met him in the agency and I didn't want to meet him in the agency.
Okay.
I wanted to meet him somewhere beautiful. Like, again, it was a bit like the childhood thing of, I'll pretend somebody died in a crash and I'll have the... I was sort of thinking, we'll meet on a beach in Kerry and we'll run into each other's arms. It'll be wonderful. But anyway, it didn't happen like that. It happened in an agency with a picture of the holy somebody or other up on the wall. You know, that sort of thing. It wasn't where I wanted it. But listen, I was absolutely thrilled to meet him. And we couldn't take our eyes off each other. We were kind of staring into each other's eyes.
Mm.
But during this time of staring into each other's eyes, the woman who had organized just kept coming in and sort of looking at him with her back to me saying, are you all right? As if like, and it just, now she probably was doing it for some good reason, except all it did was compound my guilt again. Are you okay with this woman who gave you away? Was the feeling, was what I was hearing. You know what I mean?
Oh my God.
We'd been advised that we weren't to go for a drink and we weren't to eat and everything. And eventually the two of us looked at each other and said, let's get out of here.
Yeah.
And we just went off and we had a pint and we, or a glass of wine or something. We went for ice cream or something. And
so you met, so this was in Dublin City Centre. What age is he now?
He's now 26.
Okay, so he was 26 and you walked into the room. So you'd been writing letters to each other, so you kind of knew a little bit about each other.
Yeah.
And then, so when you met him, was he taller than you thought he was going to be?
I'd seen pictures, but his pictures didn't really look like him, I thought.
You sent photos to each other in the letters?
Yeah.
Wow, okay.
Yeah. And... So he'd sent me pictures from all different times, so I couldn't really put it together. You know, he'd had weight on, he hadn't weight on, he was bald, he'd hair. So I didn't know what to expect. So when I met him, he was kind of, his hair, head was shaved and he was really dark. Like, I mean, you couldn't mistake him. He had the eyebrows of my family, that we were a big bushy eyebrow clan.
And also,
and the brown eyes.
I will say that, Maria, you look Spanish. Like, you've got like the brown hair, the brown eyes, like brown skin.
He was the same. He was very dark eyes, dark hairy eyebrows, and he was very tanned at the time, and it was very small talky, and you know you're expecting it to be all like, oh my God, where have you been all my life? But you know, we don't know each other and we're two adults really, you know. And but there's, you know, I've got the history of my baby that I held, that I remember, that I, you know, all of that, but of course he hasn't any memory of that. He's had his own family, and this person who really is a stranger is coming along, except he told me afterwards that he couldn't help looking into my eyes because he'd never met anybody who had his eyes before, who actually had his, you know, his provenance, you know, that he was from these eyes.
Yeah. That must have been very strange for him, though, because he's never met anyone that he looked like before.
I know. Incredible.
And
incredible.
So when you first met, like, did you hug each other?
Yeah, we hugged. We had a hug and we sat down. It was a little bit awkward, to be honest with you, you know, initially, partly that's because of where we were. It wasn't conducive to it wasn't like this romantic, wonderful, you know, it was kind of like I was sitting in a room waiting for him, and eventually he just walked in and I got up, and you know, tears and hugs, and you know, sat down, and there was an awkward, like, what books do you read, and do you you know, small talk. But once we got out of there, it flowed, you know. But again, out of my guilt, I thought, oh, he probably doesn't want to stay with me very long. I better go soon, you know. Yeah. Whereas I should have stayed with him all night, got langered and had a big out chat.
Yeah.
But I left at some point, you know, going by the rules of the thing. I sort of thought, I shouldn't really overdo this. But he texted me later and said, I could have stayed all night. That was wonderful. So, but that was a lovely message to hear, that he really enjoyed it.
Yes.
So we did wonderful. I went over to London soon after that and spent a weekend with him. And that was really when we really started to... Mm. You know,
to bond.
Because
he was living and working in London at the time.
He was, yeah.
So where did he grow up then, in Ireland?
He grew up in Glasnevin.
Right,
yeah,
okay.
Yeah, not very, you know, I was Dundrum. I started out in Dundrum. So he was never very far. And actually, sort of knew children of cousins of mine as well.
What?
Which is a funny little
Ireland is too small.
I know, yeah.
Isn't that crazy?
Yeah.
So so from that point on, and now not many people actually are as lucky as you.
No.
But you two actually have an amazing bond, and you still do to this day.
Yeah.
Like, you've got an incredible relationship.
Yeah, yeah. He's 38 now, and he's now married with a little baby. That's the baby I was telling you about. Yeah. He's got a little baby. And, you know, the honor to be there now as a part of his life and for this little baby. Like, I understand he has his mum and dad and, you know, there are grandparents all over the place now.
Yeah.
But it's just lovely to be, it's an honor to be a part of his life and to be included and to, you know, not to miss out on this part. You know, I missed out on so much.
Yeah.
But, you know, having said all of that, I have to be honest and say he had a lucky escape. You know, I would never have been as good as these parents that he's had. Mm. You know, I mean, he would have had a particular life and it would have been lovely in lots of ways. But he had the most amazing life with these beautiful people, really the most gorgeous people.
Yeah.
And he, you know, I'm really glad in a way, looking back, I can say now, I'm really happy for him that he had that.
Yeah.
Really, really genuinely happy for him that he had that life. And, it was worth it for him. Yeah. It was lovely. You know?
And you met his parents.
Mm, they're really gorgeous. They're just so loving and lovely. And one of the nicest things that's ever been said was, you know, I asked him when I first met him, what's your dad like and what's your mom like? And he was saying lovely things about both of them. But he said about his dad, you know, I don't think I've ever seen him not smiling. Aww. And I just thought, oh my God. That's when I realized he had a lucky escape. Because of my, I suffer a little bit with depression and things like that. So, you know what I mean? There would be bouts of that over the years where there was none of that. He didn't have to put up with any of that stuff, you know?
Yeah.
Which, you know, I went on to have three more children. And, you know, we've had a wonderful life, but there's, you know, they've had to put up with me and my depression, whereas he never did, you know? So that's, you know, that's really nice for him.
And another interesting thing, I married your third child. You're my mother-in-law.
I don't believe it.
Yes. And your son, who you found, he was one of the groomsmen at our wedding.
Aww, yeah. I know. So lovely. And the funny thing is that of all of them, he and Charlie, are really like in their funny laughter, in their sort of disposition. They're both very lighthearted and fun, and they're the image of each other. So funny, and they get on really well. That's a really lovely outcome, actually, is the feeling that the inclusiveness into the whole family. And also his biological father's side, they're actually not unlike us. They're all hairy eyebrow, black curly hair, dark brown eyes. So it's an extra strong gene he's got there of that.
And he has a relationship with his biological father
absolutely.
As well.
They get on great. We kept in contact over the years in case we'd ever meet him.
Right.
And, you know, although it was a little fling back in the day, like, you know, there's a lot of respect for the fact that both of us, you know, would have absolutely loved to have him.
You created a human together, exactly. You know. Yeah, exactly. You're always going to have that connection with him. But it's such a happy ending.
Yeah,
it really,
I know,
really
and
is.
I am aware that I'm really lucky, and I know there are situations where it didn't work out. Like, in fact, after the program, the Would You Believe program, I got letters at the time. A good many letters from people around the country who were saying they were really touched by the story and that they had been through similar things where they weren't put together with their either mother or their son or whatever, and somebody had died in the meantime, even though both of them had been looking for each other.
Oh,
so dreadful. You know, there are really, really, really sad stories still going on.
Yeah.
But hopefully the country is becoming a little bit more open about it, and there are new sort of legislation around it and things like that.
I know.
So hopefully people won't find it so difficult.
And I before I let you go, I'm sure there's people probably listening who are in a similar situation to you, and maybe they haven't found their child yet. What's the best piece of advice that you could give them?
Every situation is so individual and so different, but don't give up. Really, don't give up. And, you know, I've been told that in the situation of a guy, often it's not until they're in their 30s or late 20s that they meet a girl and somebody gives them permission to look for the, you know, so not to give up if they're 18, 19, 20 and they don't want to, they don't want anything to do with you or whatever, that it, you know, it can be just a little moment in time that just changes everything for somebody and they think, I want to know,
you know.
So never to give up, really, is all I can say, you know.
Yeah.
That's all.
Oh, well, Mia Parsons. I call you Maria because that's your name, but Mia Parsons is your beautiful jewelry and everyone needs to check it out. Thank you so much.
Oh, you're very
thank
welcome.
Thank you.
Thank
and
you
gonna,
for having me.
Yeah, I'm going to play that song as well at the end of this so everyone can hear it.
Lovely.
Song for my son, isn't
and
it?
Yeah, and actually I recorded that only a few days. That actual recording was recorded literally about, I don't know, 7 days after I wrote it.
Wow.
So it's in the raw. It's not all produced and everything. Yeah
Well, listen, thank you so much.
Me
mother-in-law.
Thank you.
I'm delighted, love.
Where are you now, my baby? Are you living close to me? What are you thinking now, my sweetheart? what is your philosophy? Has life been good to you, my darling? And do you know I hope and pray that if you ever have the time, babe, please come and look me up some. So many questions now to ask you, like where you've been and what's your name. And though we know I had my reasons, every one of them and how I hope that you forgive me. And do you know I hope and pray that if you ever have the time, babe, you'll come and look. If you ever find the time, son, please come and look me up someday. And if you ever find the time, son, please come and look me up.
That was Song for My Son by Mia Parsons. Thank you so much, Mia, for being so open and sharing such an incredible story with all of us. I hope you found this episode interesting, and if you did, please like, subscribe and share. Thank you to my husband, Charlie Moon, for the beautiful music, to Rian and Taz Kelleher for the graphics and finishing touches, and to my agent, Jane Russell, for all of your encouragement. Tune in for brand new episodes every Wednesday from 11.